The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
As the big platforms have squeezed, the threat actors have migrated to new platforms. They're trying to find the soft underbelly of the internet. And it's the second and third division sites, if you like. There's the ones which are smaller, which have fewer people, which are maybe only startups. They're a much easier target. So the operation that we were looking back in June would start off by posting stories on, for example, Medium or Reddit. It would then copy them and translate them and post them on all kinds of fringe blog sites across Europe and the United States. Then they would use those blog sites to refer to each other to build up more noise about the story. And only in the fourth or fifth iteration would they then actually post them on Facebook or Twitter with the message of activity, hey, look what the internet is talking about. And so in this operation, maybe only 5% of what was going on was on Facebook and Twitter. And all the rest was on these smaller platforms.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 21st, 2019. Today, we're bringing you a new episode from our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 election. Along with my colleagues, Evelyn Dweck and Alina Polyakova, I spoke with Ben Nimmo, the Director of Investigations at Graphica. Nimmo focuses on investigating how disinformation works. How does a researcher know where to look to find disinformation? How do you tell when a strange pattern of tweets or Facebook posts is actually a disinformation campaign? And is it possible to counter these campaigns effectively? Or is this work just a never-ending game of whack-a-mole? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 475, Ben Nimmo on the whack-a-mole game of disinformation.
Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
As you know, this is the Arbiters of Truth. So my first question to you is, what do you work on? You know, how do you define disinformation, if that's what you call it?
I work on a number of issues around manipulation and online influence efforts. I mainly think of it as information operations. I define disinformation as deliberately spreading false information. So if you're trying to identify something as disinformation, you have to be able to prove both that it's false and that it's likely that the person who is passing it is doing it deliberately. What I tend to look at these days are full-scale information operations where a threat actor, which could be a state or it could be a non-state group, will use all kinds of information, some of it true, some of it false, some of it biased or distorted, to try and influence people in the target group that they're aiming at. And so part of what I'm looking at is the information that they're spreading. Part of it is also the kind of the tools, the assets that they're using. So a lot of what I do is trying to identify fake accounts on different social platforms. It's trying to find websites which claim to be independent but appear to be actually associated with the operation. So really what I'm doing is looking around pretty much the whole breadth of the internet to try and find these kind of interference operations, particularly ones which are targeted at democracies.
So intent is seems like it's really important here in how you're thinking about your, I guess, subject and object of study. But just quick question for you. I mean, this is something we've discussed on the podcast before. You know, what do you do when, you know, an innocent bystander, your crazy uncle or grandpa or whoever, they use social media, end up sharing a piece of content that you've identified as intentionally produced to mislead? What do you do with those people who end up just organically sharing this kinds of information? How do you think about those organic entities, accounts, individuals?
My main job is actually identifying the operations in the first place and then the false pieces of information which are going out there. Once that's been done, there's still a debate going on in our community about the best way to reach the people who've been affected by the disinformation. If somebody's not doing it deliberately, if they're sharing something that they've seen online just because they believe it and they have no part in the operation itself, then in a sense they're more a victim of the operation than they are a part of it. And so there's a debate going on in the community at the moment about the best way to reach them. There are ideas, for example, that you could, on social media, get the platforms themselves to send a fact check on a piece of false information to everybody who's actually engaged with it, if they've liked it or if they've shared it. That's one approach. There's another concept which just says that you should publish the debunked thing somewhere else, or you should have some kind of tag on the piece of on a website or a social media account which says this particular story has been fact checked and found false. So there's a whole debate going on in the community at the moment. And what we need is really more study on the way different people react to different kinds of false content that they're sharing. A lot of the time what we see is that people will share the false content either because they believe that it's true or because they want to believe that it's true. It'll confirm some kind of political leaning or political bias that they already have. And so part of the question is, who's the person who's going to be telling them that actually they've shared a false piece of information? Because if it's somebody from what is seen as the other side and you tell them, hey, you've fallen for a lie, then there's a danger that you'll actually reinforce their resistance to the truth coming in because it's the wrong messenger carrying the message. So there's a lot of discussion about this at the moment, and we don't have the answers yet. And what we need to see is more research in this area.
So, Ben, if I can take even more of a step back, I'm curious, how did you get into this area in the first place? What drew you to it?
I got into this in 2014. From 2011 to 2014, I was working at NATO. And I was the NATO press officer in Brussels who was responsible for relations with Russia and Ukraine. And particularly in 2011, 2012, that was a really interesting job to be in because there was all kinds of NATO-Russia cooperation going on. There was talk about NATO and Russia running a joint operation to protect the ship that was destroying chemical weapons from Syria. So it was a really positive time in the Russia-NATO relationship. But then in 2014, you had the Russian operation to annex Crimea. You had the Russian-sponsored war in Ukraine kicking off. And the relationship really took a nosedive. But all the way through my time at NATO, there had been a strange double vision going on. I was reporting internally to NATO a lot about what Russian journalists were saying and what the Russian officials were saying. And even while you had the reset going on between Putin and Obama, even then, you had quite a lot of disinformation coming out of Russia about the kind of things NATO was doing and the ways NATO was behaving. And so I was exposed to Russian disinformation long before it was famous, if you like. I then left NATO at the end of 2014, and this was in the immediate aftermath of the Crimean operation. And the Crimean operation had been a brilliant piece of political and military maneuvering with a very large disinformation component. And so I started off by analyzing the Russian disinformation around Crimea. And the first question I looked at was whether you could actually predict the way that Russian disinformation works. And so I studied it for a while, and I realized that there are really four main things that Russian disinformation does, which are dismiss, distort, distract, and dismay. And these are the four predictable responses that you will get from the Kremlin to pretty well any kind of geopolitical incident. Once I'd done that for a while, I started getting interested in, if that's how they generate their claims, how do they then spread them to the world? And so I started looking at Kremlin official assets like RT and Sputnik and trying to work out how they operated and whether you could distinguish them from bona fide media. And then beyond RT and Sputnik, there was the question of how else is this stuff getting propagated? And that's where you start looking at all the kinds of amplification methods that happen online, like Twitter bots and like farms on Facebook and Instagram. And so from looking at the overt Kremlin assets, I started looking at the more covert ones. And then in 2017, we all saw the revelations of what the troll farm in St. Petersburg had been doing, which shone a very bright light on more weaponized social media operations coming from Russia. And so then it was a question of analyzing what those operations had done and going to try and find more. And what we're still all doing is looking for more operations like that and operations that have evolved from that and operations that are coming from different actors going on online. And we always have to remember, Russia's not the only actor in this space. There are plenty of others as well. And if you get too fixated on Russia, you miss a lot of the other stuff.
Right. Or if you get too fixated on elections, because I'm struck by the point that you make in your narrative just now that all these instances that really got you working in this area and now have pushed you towards these investigative techniques actually had nothing to do with election interference, as we call it in the United States. But of course, I think many Americans and others around the world have experienced this information through that lens of elections. And I think sometimes that makes us not see that these operations and information manipulation tactics are happening around all kinds of different issues and continuously and constantly. But I wanted to go back to something you just said and get you to talk a little bit about it. You've talked about this idea of the four Ds as kind of the framing or way of understanding how disinformation operations work. Could you just go back to that a little bit and explain again what those four Ds are and how in practice they're relevant for thinking about disinformation operations when you're doing your research?
Sure. So this started out as a piece of research I was doing in 2015, looking at the way the Kremlin and Kremlin official outlets were responding to different accusations, particularly after the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 over Ukraine, which, according to all the open source evidence, was shot down using a missile provided by the Russian military. And I tried to categorize the different ways that the Kremlin would react to criticisms. And I worked out that there was a 4D pattern, which you can think of as dismiss, distort, distract, and dismay. So dismiss, if you're accused of something, then you simply say, there's no point listening to the accuser because. And the because can typically be because they're a Russophobe or because they are a habitual liar or because they don't have experience in this field or because they're simply an armchair journalist from the middle of England. But the whole idea is to make people not even look at the evidence by rubbishing the witness. One of my favorite examples was late 2017, the actor Morgan Freeman voiced a video which accused Russia of interfering in the U.S. election. And there was a whole pushback on that by various Kremlin voices, including the Russian embassy to South Africa, which put out a meme of Morgan Freeman smoking marijuana and saying, well, Morgan Freeman accused us of interfering, but he smokes dope the whole time. Why would you even listen to him? And that's the absolute epitome of the dismiss technique. Your accuser of being a drug user, and therefore you try to stop your audience listening to them. And that's really the most common tactic we see from the Kremlin. Then you have distort, which is if the evidence is against you, just make up evidence of your own. You either twist the facts or you create new ones. And the classic example of that would be after the shooting down of MH17 over Ukraine, the Russian Defense Ministry published satellite images, which it claimed showed two Russian anti-aircraft missiles near the site of the shooting down. And this was part of the whole Kremlin narrative that it must have been Ukraine's fault. The investigative group Bellingcat ran forensic studies on those satellite images and concluded that they'd been photoshopped. And what had been photoshopped in was the images of the Ukrainian anti-aircraft missiles. So you have the Russian Defense Ministry producing falsified evidence to try and bolster its case. And that's classic distortion of the evidence. And then you have the distraction technique, which to those who are Soviet scholars would refer to as whataboutism, which is simply if you're accused of somebody, you accuse somebody else of the same thing. So when Russia is accused of shooting down MH17, the response might be, well, you shot down an airliner in 1980. If Russia is accused of supporting chemical attacks against civilians in Syria, the response might be, well, you used Agent Orange over Vietnam. The idea is not to draw a valid historical parallel, it looks like the idea is simply to muddy the waters and to distract people from the main point, which is that, according to all the open source evidence, Russia supported the Assad regime after it used chemical weapons against its own people. But it's a distraction attempt. It's simply trying to throw up a smokescreen around the main point of what's actually being discussed. And then the final point is dismay. If you're really annoyed about something, you try and scare people off with highly exaggerated rhetoric. And the classic example of that would be when Denmark was discussing contributing a radar frigate to NATO's missile defense in, I think, 2015. The Russian ambassador to Denmark did an interview with the largest Danish daily newspaper, Jyllands-Posten, saying that effectively, if Denmark goes through this, then of course Russia will have to put Denmark on the nuclear strike list. So it's literally going nuclear in the rhetorical sense. And what you're doing is saying, if you keep doing this, then the world will come to an end. And it looks like the idea is, you know, clearly people don't want the world to come to an end. So the idea is to sow dismay in your audience. For me, the utility of dismiss, distort, distract, and dismay is that you can both use this as an analytical tool. So you can categorize what the Kremlin is saying by one of these four techniques, but also you can use it to predict what they're going to be saying, because it's such a standard pattern that pretty well for any accusation which comes against the Kremlin, these are the four techniques that will be used. Now, it's important to point out that it's not only the Kremlin which does this. China has done the same thing over the South China Sea. I've seen reports which say that Donald Trump has done the same thing. I've seen reports that say both sides in the Brexit campaign were doing variations on this theme. So it's not that this is a piece of specifically Russian doctrine. It looks like it's more a fairly standard set of responses to hostile criticism. It's not just a Russian thing, but it does seem to hold true in certainly the circumstances that I've looked at.
Just to follow that up a little bit, you keep noting that this is not just about Russia over and over again, and I completely agree with you that Russia may have pioneered this playbook, but now it has gone global. And of course, recently we saw these takedowns, some of the first takedowns of Chinese-based accounts that were accused of sowing discord during the Hong Kong protests. And one thing you said in one of your media quotes at the time was, and I quote, it's almost like everywhere you look, you're finding the stuff. And so I guess our question to you is, you know, how do you decide where to look if this stuff is really everywhere? So how do you prioritize what to look at? How do you start that research process?
It depends a little bit what platform you're looking at, but as a general rule, in my field, what I'm most interested in is the large scale and potentially state backed or state influenced operations. And these tend to cluster around political events. They particularly cluster around political events in the country you're looking at. And one of the important things to remember is that most of the information operations that we know about and that we've seen taken down around the world have been domestic ones. So it's been groups or people associated with governments in a particular country targeting critics or the opposition in that country, or trying to boost the government in that country. So most of this stuff is domestic rather than foreign interference. But with that in mind, if there's a major incident or a major case of civil disturbance in a particular country, that's normally a sign that it's worth going in and starting looking whether there are signs of some kind of information operation going on. And the Hong Kong protests are a really good example where, to start with, there seemed to be relatively little coordinated behavior. And then the longer they went on, the more there was evidence of fairly clumsy pro-Chinese government campaigns starting to run on the main social platforms. And you have what appears to have been directly government-linked operations, which largely seem to have bought tons of compromised accounts from the black market online, repurposed them to pushing out very large volumes of pro-Chinese spam and then just letting them run. And then around that, you had strange kind of spam networks, which didn't appear to be directly run by the government, but were doing very much the same kind of thing and were using hijacked or bought accounts to try and push the message. And on that one, it was relatively easy to expose some of this stuff because the operations were fairly clumsy. And for example, when you find a bunch of accounts on YouTube or channels on YouTube which have a million views because 3 years ago they were posting lots of British sitcoms or posting lots of Japanese anime cartoons. And then they went silent for 2 years, and then they're suddenly posting videos attacking the Hong Kong protesters. Then it's pretty unlikely that that's a single user who happened to be fascinated by British sitcoms back in 2017, then went silent for 2 years, and then suddenly learned fluent Chinese and started posting political content. That's a pretty good indication that you need to start suspecting that that account has been either hacked and taken over or has just been sold on. And normally what we'll see is that where you have political or geopolitical clashes these days, it's worth looking for various sorts of online operation. The other classic example would be in the Middle East, where you have the influence struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And we've seen, particularly from Facebook, a number of takedowns of Iranian operations in late 2018 and early this year. And then later on this year, we saw a number of takedowns of Saudi operations. And they were very much targeting the same kind of geopolitical issues, particularly around Yemen and around the Muslim Brotherhood and the general state of security in the Gulf region. And that's a case where it looks like there's a geopolitical rivalry going on between Saudi and Iran, which is playing out on the ground, and it's also playing out online.
So something that I find really interesting about what you just said is, you know, your focus really is on political operations and in moments of geopolitical conflict. But when the platforms talk about this, often they talk about the fact that they're taking down the coordinated inauthentic behavior is the term, not because of the content that they post, but because of the way in which these networks are operating. And so I guess my question is, how do you distinguish between sort of permissible coordinated behavior that maybe large parts of the internet seem to operate on? So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, there was a report by Popular Information about a bunch of websites affiliated with the Daily Wire that seemed to be coordinating to drive traffic to Daily Wire content. And Facebook said this wasn't against its rules. How do you distinguish between those kinds of networks and the political networks that you're interested in looking at, apart from by content?
You can think of the content as the clue and the initial marker. It's something that you have to look at. But most of the time, what you're looking for is the behavior behind the content, if you like, and the behavior of the accounts themselves. And that's partly because actually it's a lot easier to prove that an account is fake or hijacked or bought or repurposed than it is to argue that actually the account is definitely posting content at the orders of some government, because unless you actually have the smoking invoice, you can't actually see what the orders are. And I don't think anybody in this space who's serious about it actually wants to be in the business of censorship. There are genuine people out there who believe all kinds of crazy stuff. And in fact, one of the lessons that I've learned in the past 5 years of doing this is that nothing is too crazy for the internet. But unless there's an actual harm in the content, unless it's somebody who is, for example, saying that all vaccines are bad, or somebody who's spreading false information about how and where you can vote, opinions are opinions, and I don't want to be messing with that. But if you're looking for an operation, then the content gives you the clue to look between accounts. So, for example, if you are looking for coordinated behavior on Twitter, one of the things that you might see is that one particular account is posting at a very high volume, is posting, you know, dozens of times per minute. What you can then do is you can take the language of that tweet, put it into a Twitter search in inverted commas, and then see if there are other accounts which are doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. And if you find that 20 or 200 or 2,000 or 20,000 accounts all posted exactly the same wording at the same time, then that's a pretty strong indication that that is not simply organic behavior. There's somebody behind that who is pushing that from all those accounts at the same time. Now, you then enter the question of whether that's just coordination, and there are ways that this kind of thing can be coordinated entirely legitimately. But what you're using is the content to serve as, it's a way to find what other accounts are posting the same thing. In the same way, some of the recent Russian takedowns we've seen, there was one tentatively attributed to the Internet Research Agency in mid-October. Something that we saw there was that accounts which claimed to be independent were all posting the same memes, not all at the same time, maybe a few days apart, but repeatedly they were sharing the same content and there weren't other accounts sharing the same thing. So at that point, you can say, okay, those accounts seem to form a cluster. And then you start looking for other clues as to their behavior. Another thing that particularly in the context of foreign influence operations we've seen, the content can be useful if the operators aren't very good at English. Because repeatedly what we've seen is accounts that masquerade as Americans, but they're not actually any good at English language in cases where you would expect them to be. It's not that they are posing as Americans of a foreign background. They're posing as English language Native Americans, and yet they can't write in English properly in ways that are characteristic of foreigners who've tried to learn the language and haven't quite learned it properly. So there, the content is important because you're looking for language clues, but it's not the sentiment of the content that you look at or you care about, because a lot of these operations are, they'll have accounts masquerading as conservatives and as liberals, as Black Lives Matter and as Blue Lives Matter. You're looking at the content for the clues it gives you about the language of the user who's behind it.
So one of the things you mentioned was the revelations in 2017 about the operations in the 2016 US election. And one of the big themes of the reports to do with the investigations around that was how these operations are often very sophisticated cross-platform operations. And I'm wondering how important platform coordination is in identifying these operations and how good platform coordination is.
It's really important. It's a lot better than it used to be, but it's not nearly good enough yet. If you think back to 2016, there was the platform sleepwalked into this, and indeed law enforcement sleepwalked into this. There was really no awareness of how massive the Russian operation had been until the big takedowns of, I think, September 2017. Since then, there has been a lot of improvement, and more we've been seeing almost simultaneous announcements from different platforms of the stuff they've taken down. Hong Kong is a good example. You had Twitter announcing that it had taken down hundreds of thousands of accounts. I think on the same day you had Facebook announcing that it had found related accounts on its platform. And then within a couple of days you had Google coming out saying that it had also done a takedown. So there's a lot more information sharing than there used to be. My sense is that it needs to be done at an earlier stage so that all the platforms can run their investigations in parallel from an earlier point. But clearly there are all kinds of sensitivities about platforms sharing information with each other. But the other big lack is that there need to be more platforms brought into the discussion. I was involved in June in exposing an operation that was run from Russia, and by the signs of it looked like it was run by one of the Russian intelligence agencies, which was working across about 40 different platforms, including blogging websites, including Wow. sites like Medium. They had accounts on Reddit. They had accounts all the way across the internet. And something that we've seen more and more in the past year or year and a half, as the big platforms have squeezed, the threat actors have migrated to new platforms. They're trying to find the soft underbelly of the internet. And it's the second and third third division sites, if you like. There's the ones which are smaller, which have fewer people, which are maybe only startups. They're a much easier target. So the operation that we were looking back in June would start off by posting stories on, for example, Medium or Reddit. It would then copy them and translate them and post them on all kinds of fringe blog sites across Europe and the United States. Then they would use those blog sites to refer to each other to build up more noise about the story. And only in the fourth or fifth iteration would they then actually post them on Facebook or Twitter with the message effectively, hey, look what the internet is talking about. And so in this operation, maybe only 5% of what was going on was on Facebook and Twitter. And all the rest was on these smaller platforms. And until you have smaller platforms like that involved in the discussion and given the ability to go and track down what's happening on their platforms, the soft underbelly is going to remain soft.
Can you just tell us more about that operation you're describing? Because, it sounds absolutely fascinating. 40 platforms is unbelievable.
And only 5% on Twitter and Facebook.
It was a fascinating operation to dig into, and it was one of my favorite pieces of investigation because it was so wide-ranging and because the operators were trying so hard to hide. We called this operation secondary infection, infection spelled with a K, because it seemed to be modeled on the Soviet operation infection back in the 80s, which was the claim that the United States had created the AIDS virus in a weapons lab. Now, the original Operation Infection started off by posting that false claim in, I think, an Indian newspaper that was pro-Soviet. They then posted it in an Italian newspaper that was pro-Soviet and then got it picked up by a convenient East German supporter. And so they built up this international portfolio of places where the story had surfaced. And it was only after that that the main Soviet media started jumping on it and saying, look what independent people around the world are reporting. Why is this and what's happening? So they'd created the story, but they'd planted it in enough places that they were trying to make it look like it was a spontaneous production. So that was Operation Infection back in the 80s. What we found with Operation Secondary Infection is that it was doing the same kind of thing for the internet. So normally the operation would create some kind of forged document. It might be a fake tweet. It might be a faked email. Normally they would take a screenshot of a communication and then they'd just Photoshop it to add the words that they wanted. Then they would post that on a blog site somewhere from an account that they created that day and they only ever used for that one thing. And they would post it with maybe two lines of text saying, hey, here's something funny I found. And then they'd abandon that account. They'd never go back to it. They then create a second account on the same platform, and they post a separate story saying, hey, look what I just saw that somebody else posted on this platform. And they'd link back to the first account. And then they'd abandon the second account and never go back to it. They then create a third account on the same platform and write a full-length article, maybe 8 or 10 paragraphs, saying, wow, look at what people on this platform have now found and discussing. This is a really big story because... And they try and build it up into a sensational kind of story. And they then post that on the first platform and maybe 4 or 5 other ones, all of them quite small. And then they'd abandon all the accounts that they'd done that with. Then they'd translate it into maybe 4 or 5 different languages and do the same thing. And they'd always be ditching their accounts. We almost never found any accounts from this operation which posted 2 stories. They were almost all single-shot accounts. And then finally, they'd go to a Facebook account and a Twitter account that they ran, which were repetitive, that they'd use for multiple stories. And they'd start posting links to the different online assets that they'd created. But they'd try them and drop them in particularly sensitive groups, or on Twitter, they would actually directly address these to politicians or investigative reporters, basically saying, hey, you have to see what's happening on the internet. You have to see this amazing story that people have now found. Now, some of their stories were absolutely hilarious. One of my favorites was that they claimed to have an email from the Spanish foreign minister to the head of the intelligence committee in the Spanish parliament, saying, we need you to tell the Brits that we've just uncovered an extremist Remainer plot to assassinate Boris Johnson to stop Brexit. It's so insane on so many levels. It's just laughable. And they tried to launder this through dozens of different fake accounts. And in the end, they were posting it on Facebook and Twitter and at tagging journalists, trying to get them to pick up on the story. There was a story in the US context where they created a fake tweet from Senator Marco Rubio accusing British intelligence of interfering in the midterm elections in 2018 by creating deep fakes to support the Democrats. Now, this was a tweet that Rubio had never posted, but what they'd done is they'd taken a screenshot of a real tweet and then photoshopped it to add different words. But again, they started pushing this out to different political discussion groups on Facebook and on Twitter, trying to get it picked up by more mainstream characters. And they were doing this repeatedly. We found literally dozens of different forgeries that they'd created. And it was really difficult to move from one to the next because they were always leaving this trail of burned accounts behind them. They would typically create an account, post one story, and then never go back to it. And only a couple of times did they slip up, and we managed to work out where they'd slipped up. And if you like, to spider out from the stories we knew about to find new ones. But the other side of that was that even though their stories were, if you like, very well hidden, they were very hard to catch. They were actually so well hidden that pretty well nobody on the internet even noticed. So they spent an enormous amount of work trying to push their stories out there. But with one exception, their stories just didn't catch on. They didn't get picked up by the mainstream media. They didn't get picked up by any of the sites that they were targeting, because they were eternally creating new social media accounts. And for all of us on social media, you know that the hardest thing is getting your first follower. They were putting themselves in the situation that they always had to get the first follower. They never got as far as follower two. And so it was a very strange operation in the sense that the operational security was brilliant, but for exactly that reason, the impact was absolutely lousy. And I've never actually seen an operation which had so much input for so little output.
That's fascinating. I mean, so is this then a case of kind of whack-a-mole where the bigger platforms are becoming more aggressive in moderation, stricter, but, you know, the disinformation just pops up elsewhere and then flows back? Or is this actually a situation in which, because, you know, Twitter and Facebook are more aggressively moderating, disinformation operations take more work and then are ultimately less successful, even though they can kind of be laundered through, you know, blogs and platforms like Reddit?
The main trend I've seen in the last year and a half or 2 years is that it's still whack-a-mole, but if you like, each time the mole gets whacked, they get more concussion, so it's harder to come back. And particularly what the best example of that is the Russian Internet Research Agency, the IRA, which ran the original operation from 2014 to 18, because we've now seen at least four different generations of IRA assets taken down. Some of what they've done has been very consistent throughout. So they've tended to masquerade as pro-Trump MAGA supporters, as Black Lives Matter groups, as LGBT groups, as Southern Confederate groups. You know, as ever, they're trying to push both sides of inflammatory stories. But each time they've come back, they've been trying harder to hide. But because they're trying harder to hide, they've been less good at getting engagement. And that's the effect we tend to be seeing more and more, is that because information operations like this are now being hunted, they're trying really, really hard to blend in with their target audiences. But by definition, the more you blend in, the less you stand out. And on social media, as we all know, the whole point is to try and stand out, because that's how you win audience. So we're getting closest to a situation where there are still information operations on the main platforms, but because they're trying so hard to hide, they're having to sacrifice engagement to stay hidden. And as long as they stay hidden, there's much less impact they can actually have.
So that's fascinating, because my question to you was going to be to give us a better sense of what we can expect going forward, because what you've been describing now is how these multitude of actors, not just Russia, but other state actors and also non-state actors, have adapted and evolved their tactics and their strategies as social media companies have been responding and as there's been just much more general attention to these kinds of information operations. And as, you know, investigators and hunters like you and others have also been identifying these campaigns in much more in real time than we used to have the capability to do. Although I will say, from everything you just told us, it sounds incredibly, incredibly painfully tedious to have to do all this. And so I guess a two-pronged question to kind of start to get us looking more at what to expect. You know, what are the kind of future trends that you're really worried about? Obviously, in the U.S., there's a lot of concern around 2020. We know this is not just about elections, but that is going to be kind of a peak of concern. So what are some of the key threats you see? And I think on the research side, then, do you see some, you know, evolution, developments in how we're doing this kind of research to make it easier, to make it faster, so that we can try to get ahead of this threat instead of being in this whack-a-mole pattern?
In terms of 2020, and particularly the US election, the thing I'm worried about most now is Americans trying to copy what the Russians did. There seems to be a perception out there that you can throw an American election just by doing some social media trolling. Now, I think that's significantly flawed as an argument, because it misses all that Russia did on the hacking and leaking side. But the perception is out there, and we've already seen incidents on both sides of the political spectrum in the US where domestic actors have started experimenting with what the Russians were doing during live democratic exercises. And my worry is that even though I think the perception is flawed, because the perception is out there, more and more domestic actors are going to think, hey, maybe I can interfere in the election by running a little troll farm of my own. And it gets much more difficult to deal with that kind of thing when it's Americans doing it to Americans, because if it's a foreign actor targeting Americans, there's a really easy and obvious justification, which is pretty well universally understood, that you don't want foreigners interfering in your election. And so it's very easy to take action. Once it's Americans doing it, it gets harder to identify, and it's sometimes harder to justify what you do about it, unless they're actually running fake accounts, in which case you take down the fake accounts because they're fake accounts. So my worry is not so much the large-scale foreign information operations getting better at what they're doing, but it's more a proliferation of small domestic actors trying to do the same thing. And the other big concern I have is still hacking and leaking. I don't think there's been anything like enough understanding of how devastating the Russian hacking and leaking in 2016 was. For, by my reckoning, that was far more significant in the electoral cycle than any of the trolling was. But it hasn't had the same degree of attention. And I don't even know how much effort the campaigns themselves are putting into their cyber defensive. Because in cyber, of all things, you are only as strong as the weakest link. And all it takes is for one member of one campaign to get compromised. And then the attackers can use that to hoover up all kinds of internal emails. And so my other big concern is still hacking and leaking. Because that's not something, if there is genuinely a hacking attack on a campaign, and if their emails start leaking a few weeks or a few months before the election, there's absolutely nothing the platforms can do about it, because it's going to be out there in the public domain. If the threat actor posts it on a website somewhere, you can't realistically ask the social platforms to take down every single piece of content which references those leaks, because for sure you're going to get mainstream media writing about it. And so my other big concern is really the underappreciation of the danger of hacking and leaking, and particularly from political campaigns, whether they appreciate how vulnerable they are.
I want to just push again on the idea of transparency and the standards that are being used here, because obviously a lot of this stuff, true or false, involves what on its face looks like political speech. And so there are concerns that are raised around censorship or the consistency of enforcement. And a lot of these standards are quite opaque. But one of the pushbacks you get is that this is an arms race. And if you're really transparent about the standards that you're using to catch operations, that just enables the bad actors to game those rules and be more effective the next time round. And so I guess my question is, do you think there is capacity to be more transparent without enabling that? Or is it just sort of a trade-off that we're going to have to live with?
I think we're always going to have the trade-off because as an investigator, there are tricks I use that I certainly don't want the bad actors knowing about, because then they'll find a way around them. And so from the investigative point of view, it's always a balance between explaining how you know what you know without giving away how you actually found it. And so what you'll see in a lot of reports is that the report will start saying, where's the effect of, we found these assets and then we proved that they were all connected because of X, Y, and Z. But the big question is, well, how did you find them? And that's the question that you're not going to get answered, because the hope is that you'll be able to use that technique to find the same accounts again. And we've seen many times that the threat actors have been trying hard. There was a really good statement by Facebook on the 31st of July 2018 when they announced the takedown of the second generation of Russian IRA accounts. And they actually explained at that point that, for example, the original IRA had registered some of their accounts to Russian mobile phone numbers, which in hindsight is pretty weird when you're talking about an account which claims to be an American. And they were browsing from Russian IP addresses. Whereas the second generation of IRA operations were always using proxy servers in the US, and they were using more and more internet phone numbers rather than real phone numbers. So you can see there that even without information, the threat actors have tried to work out what would have given them away. And then they're trying to avoid that mistake again. So on the one hand, on the investigative side, we don't want to be giving away our trade secrets. But what we do need to be able to do is explain to people, how do we know that this particular piece or that this particular operation can be attributed to this particular actor? And so there's always going to be a balance between transparency on what you know and what you can prove, and not actually giving away your whole hand, because the job is really to find the next operation as well. When one operation is taken down, there will be another one. We've seen, particularly from the major state operators like Russia, like Iran, like China, that you take down one network and they will try and work out how you got them. They will try and work a way around that, and then they will come back. And then the game starts again. Now, that the good thing is that that's a big difference from 2016, when you could run a Twitter account pretending to be a Tennessee Republican and you could register it to a Russian mobile phone number. And even when the genuine Tennessee Republican Party complained, it still wouldn't get taken down. That was the kind of crazy world we were in 2016. Those days are definitely over, and the platforms are actually looking for this stuff. But now we are in that cat and mouse game where you need to be able to prove to people how you know stuff, but you don't want to be giving away techniques that will hopefully allow you to expose more operations in the future. So it's a difficult balance.
Yeah, I confess that makes me feel a little better about never knowing what it means when I read these reports and it says, we found these many accounts. I think thank you so much for your time. This is incredibly interesting, and we'll leave it there.
That's great. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the fourth episode of Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast's new mini-series on disinformation. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare Podcast feed. And remember to check for new episodes every Thursday. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Ben Nimmo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer was Jacob Schultz. And this podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patya-Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. And as always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.